Today is a really special episode. I have Ian Lyon with me. Ian is the managing director of Atoll Travel. And for anyone who's been to the Maldives surfing, know that they're a really big name. They might or might not have been involved in actually putting the Maldives on the map as a surf destination. Atoll Travel is rooted in history, and I'm stoked to have Ian here with me to tell me a little bit more about how it all started, a little bit more about Tony. We get to Tony later on. And yeah, Ian, I'm super happy to have you on the show. How are you?
Thanks, Sonny. Pleasure to be with you.
We tried this a couple of times. It's been 3 or 4 days of trying to connect and actually do this show. So I'm really happy like it works for now. So I just wanted to ask you a little bit more about Atoll Travel and how it all started. I mean, you have been in the industry for over 30 years, I believe. And yeah, tell me a little bit more how you actually got into the industry and how you actually got to start Atoll Travel.
Well, probably the only one in the industry that didn't actually set out to get into it. I was a good friend of Tony's from the early 80s when we met each other in Sri Lanka over a few years. And I went and stayed out in the Maldives in 1984 with Tony for a couple of months. And some year or two later, I ended up back in Australia doing a few things like trying to build a house, etc. And I was doing a bit of work with a travel agency, just helping them out, doing relief management stuff when they were away. Tony and I were communicating, as it was by aerograms in those days. And he said, one day, right, he said, travel agency, learn your trade well, mate. We might need to use that one day. Little did I know that at the time he and his wife, Zulfa, were setting up Atoll Adventures. It's about 1989. So he and Zulfa set up Atoll Adventures, the Maldives tour company. And then got on to me and said, right, you're going to manage the bookings, which I did through a local agency for the first couple of years before we set up Atoll Travel in late 95 as a standalone agency, set up primarily to support the tours of Atoll Adventures.
Yeah, that sounds like a great little intro for, you know, how you actually got started. I actually want to touch a little bit more on Tony, right? Like he's the founding father of surfing in the Maldives. Like he put the Maldives on the map because of a trip that should have never led him to the Maldives in the first place. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that trip that Tony landed in the Maldives, but he didn't want to be there in the first place, right? That was never his plan.
No, that wasn't the intention. He and his mate, Mark Scanlon, they grew up together. They're both Maroubra boys from Sydney. And they were hanging out in Sri Lanka at the time, this is 1973, and decided that they wanted to get to Africa. They wanted to surf Jeffreys Bay, which was kind of like the mecca for traveling surfers in the early 70s. You visited a lot of different places. Many of them that you go to now weren't on the list back then. Certainly Bali, Sri Lanka, Mauritius, South Africa were some of the main places that people went to in the early 70s for their surfing. Sort of like, it wasn't a backpacker thing, it was like a backpacker thing with a surfing slant to it. But Mark and Tony were in a tea shop down in Colombo, I think it was, and happened to bump into this older American guy, 50-year-old, somewhat strange personality, and struck up a conversation with him. Turned out that he had this really very luxurious sailing yacht, and his crew had left in Sri Lanka, so he was looking for some new crew. And, said, oh, you guys are surfers. You must know a bit about the ocean. And they said, oh, yeah, oh, it's fine. So they jumped on this boat and hitchhiked, supposedly to get themselves across to Mauritius and then Africa. But whether the old captain didn't read the chart too well or whether he thought the Maldives was a line of cockroach shit down the map, they ran aground on the reef in the middle of the night in late 73. As far as Tony was concerned, that was the first wave he'd ever surfed in the Maldives, because the boat remarkably got picked up by the wave and wedged into the reef at right angles. It didn't broach, so it didn't roll over. It just wedged in upright. And they had to stay on the boat till the morning, and local villagers all came out, most amused by this flash Western yacht that had come into the reef. And they spent the next... The Maldives back then, tourism had really just only the first one or two resort islands had opened. They were very basic. The Maldives government didn't even have a stamp for your passport back in those days. And so the news of the wreck got around, and they were a bit of a celebrity in Male when they got down to Male. And they spent the next number of months helping out salvage what they could from the boat, and then the boat got dragged off the reef and dry docked and repaired. They left the captain to do his job of working out what to do with his boat then. So after they'd finished the salvaging, they did a bit of travelling around the country, travelling around the country in the Maldives when it's 1,192 specks of islands and no public transport system was pretty interesting. In those days, they used to just get lifts on fishing boats and supply boats. They explored the place a bit. They came back up to, I think they might have quickly gone back over to Sri Lanka, and then Tony thought, no, I'm going to go back to that spot in the Maldives. Seasons changed, winds are changing, swells should be coming. There's got to be some waves out there. So he came back with a friend and got a boat, jumped on a local fishing boat guy, went to have a look around the eastern side of North Male Atoll, and came around a corner, and here was this reeling left-hander just barreling around the corner. Tony looked at the Maldivian guy and said, where's the next nearest village? And the Maldivian guy pointed over his shoulder to the island of Himmafushi, and he said, right, that's where I'm going to live. And so he did. From 74 onwards, his basic residence was on the island of Himmafushi, which is the island that jailbreaks is on, next door to Honkins.
Do you actually know where he ran into trouble in the first place? Like, where did the boat actually hit the reef? Was that in the Male area, or was it close to, you know, where Cinnamon Don Valley Pasta Point is today? Or do you know the exact spot?
No, I don't know the exact spot, but I think it was the atoll to the north of North Male Atoll, which would be might have been Laviani. Mm-hmm. It might have been right up the north of Male Atoll. I'm actually not too sure on exactly where it was, Sonny, but I know when they were doing the salvage, they were staying in Male, and they'd have to get a sailing dhoney, and I think the sail was about 6 or 7 hours to get up to the wreck. They'd do the salvaging for 4 or 5 hours and then sail back again down to Male. So it must have been a fair distance.
Okay. And I understand that Tony, when he first ran into trouble and then he realized, well, there's waves in the Maldives and there's surf, he actually kept it a secret for a very long time. He only surfed it, well, A, by himself, and B, with his very close friends. So when did it start to like shift, when he was kind of like, well, you know, we could actually make a business out of it? And when did that happen?
Yeah, well, Tony used to joke. He said, I knew that we were going to have to get, you know, do something commercial with it sooner or later. But he said, it was like marriage. I put it off as long as I could. But in the end, it just had to happen. So, yeah, it was a very tightly held secret. I first went there in early 84, Tony having let me in on the secret during one of our afternoon discussions over at Arrigan Bay in Sri Lanka. For some reason, he decided he'd let me in on the secret. I mean, he'd met hundreds of surfers at Harrigan Bay over the years, but they all grilled him on, oh, where are you from? The Maldives? There must be surf over there. And Tony's response was, no, well, there isn't. If there was, why am I over here with you 40 blokes trying to get away in the crowd? Which was a fairly reasonable response.
Yeah,
so absolutely. The word was there was no surf in the Maldives. But there was Tony and Mark, of course, who was in the shipwreck. His good mate Gary, who was a family friend of the Hine family in Sydney. Gary spent a couple of years out on the island with Tony in the late 70s. South African Fred, who's Fred's ledge on the inside of Honkies.
Right,
bowl,
okay.
That's named after Fred.
Yep.
Himself open. There was Buzzer and two or three others. By the time I visited there in 84, and Mark and Gary were actually having a visit at the time. They used to pop over for a few weeks at a time. And we were sitting around one night talking about it, and I said, well, you know, you discovered the waves in 74. It's now 84. How many guys have surfed between then and now? And Gary and Mark and Tony sat there and you're the 10th. I said, 10 people in 10 years are the one, and they said, yeah, you're the 10th.
That's
it's a very tightly held secret. Well, I mean, when I got the letter, I was living in Mauritius, and I got the letter from Tony to say that if you want to come out and stay on the island like we discussed, you've got to do it before May 84 because they're going to change the rulings on what were the guest houses then, which were really just family homes with a spare room. And but of course, there was, you know, don't tell anyone where you're going. You've got to keep the secret. And I was travelling with one of my oldest mates in Mauritius, and we were going to be heading to South Africa. And I said to a mate, sorry, can't tell you where I'm going, but I'm disappearing for a while. And 20 years later, said, gee, you didn't even tell your mate Sid. I said, well, you told me not to tell anyone. So I didn't tell anyone. My parents didn't know where I'd gone. I just sent my parents a telegram or an aerogram to say, you won't hear from me for a few months because I'm going to some isolated islands. I didn't tell them where. So anybody that was in on the secret was really, we'd sworn in blood on that secret. We weren't telling anyone. So by the time the late 80s came along, there was a bit of word of mouth. Tony by that stage said, well, you know, if you know somebody that you trust, they'll keep a secret, tell them to book at this hotel, and I'll come out and take them out with my Zodiac. By that stage, yeah, Zodiac. And some actually were quite well-known surfing industry names were in the first, you know, 30 or 40, and they all kept the secret. Nobody ever muttered a word about it. So by the late 80s, there was probably, oh, I don't know, 50 or 60 people in the world that knew of the surf, but we were pretty much all keeping it a secret.
I mean, that's just
But what was happening amazing. In the Maldives was that tourism was growing.
Yeah.
And you know, one by one, another island would get a hotel, and then another island would get a hotel. And by the late 80s, as Tony explained it to me, he said, mate, it's just a matter of time before some French or South African or Australian honeymooner comes out here and he's on the boat out with his girl, and they'll come around the corner of these islands and see these waves and just go, what the? And you know, with the way tourism's growing here, these breaks in North Maui Atoll aren't that far from the airport, and the resorts were all being built in that region. So we knew that purely because of the tourism that was coming along, that it was pointless trying to keep it a secret any longer. And there was one bloke who had come out, and Tony had taken the surfing, and he was going to keep the secret, but he decided he wanted to do a little thing on his own without telling Tony. So these things all happened about the same time in about 88, 89. So Tony and Zulfa set up Atoll Adventures and said, right, we're going to run a bona fide tour company.
So what was the actual final step? Did Tony decide to start the company, Atoll Adventures, and kind of put it on the map publicly, or was there somebody else who did it before him?
No, it was there was a bit of this other individual did actually put a bit of publicity in one of the Queensland newspapers at about the time that we were producing our first flyers.
Yeah. Okay.
Because we didn't have any money in those days to do any marketing, and so I just got printed up a load of flyers and got the mailing address of just about every surf shop around Australia, folded up three flyers, put it in an envelope and posted it off to see what would happen. Because, you know, back then the fax was the latest piece of technology.
Yeah, right.
That was the best way for Tony and Zulf and I to communicate, was by fax.
Yeah, okay.
That was new. So this is, you know, 1990 thereabouts. So he was very torn because at the start there was we wanted some publicity, but we didn't want to blow the name out there completely. We wanted to sort of seep out over time, which was probably a bit naive of us that we could, you know, take a softly approach to it. But we did the first couple of magazine trips and didn't name it as the Maldives there. Put a Divi Hiraj was one of the articles, which is a Maldivian name for the Maldive Islands.
Where was the first article published? In Australia, like in a newspaper or a surf mag, or how did that
Surfing
work?
Surfing mag. I think, what was that? That must have been 92 or 93. Australian Surfing Life with Ted Rambo. Actually, it was Ted Rambo that had sort of been in contact with Tony, and Tony contacted me and was surprised to find out that Ted grew up in the area that I live, and where I live now, a bit down the coast from where I was when we were young, but actually knew Ted's sister pretty well and Ted a bit. And by that stage, Ted Rambo's name in surf photography was getting pretty well about. And he wanted to go out. It was a new area. Ted loved going to new areas. But it was a matter about getting the sponsors together, whether it was Billabong or Rip Curl or whoever, and the magazines on board. So Ted did the first trip out there, and I think that was 92 or 93. And then there was another trip done with Trax magazine.
Yeah.
So there were two articles that were done in that early year. Maldives wasn't named as such, but you wouldn't have needed to be much of a genius to work out where it was. And then, obviously, it started to pop up, and you know, we were running little ads in tracks and wherever we could afford to. It went on from there. It gradually got more and more publicity, and like anything, you know, once we were doing it and this other guy in Queensland was doing a little boat charter thing, then, of course, it didn't take long for the surf travel industry. There was only a few people involved in it in those days, and, you know, progressively, one by one, more companies turned up until there's now, I don't know, there's, there's dozens and dozens and dozens of surf travel companies around the world now, whereas
back
then there
was absolutely true.
There was about three of us.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, we're talking about the 90s or even earlier than that, and obviously, like, maps, they didn't really exist the way we have them today, where we can just, you know, kind of flip open our phones and check, you know, where we want to go and how we want to get there. So, and I understand that back in the day, Tony and I guess his entourage, that included you as well, you guys actually named a lot of the spots in the area, like in North Mali. How did that go about? Like, how did you guys go around and say, all right, well, you know, we call this one Honkies, and then, you know, you kind of move on to the next break. And so talk to me about that. Like, how, what was the idea behind those names as well?
By the time I got there, Tony had been there 10 years. So he had his nicknames for the different breaks. It wasn't like he set out to name them in particular, except for Honkies. Tony's nickname was Honky. And that was the first wave he saw that, you know, came reeling around the corner and barreling through the bowl. That was the moment that his life-changing decision was that he was going to hang in the Maldives, because how good's his surf? And he adopted the country and the country adopted him. But, I mean, he had his little nicknames for it, but he'd always called Honkies Honkies, although we called it sometimes Crystal Corner at Capes and Fats. We had a few other little names that was there, but basically that one was always Honkies. And then, the one at Jailbreak, called Jailbreak now, but back then when I first stayed there on the island in 84, there was a proper jail there. And, I'd walk from Tony's house down through the bush track, get to nearly the jail wall, and you'd wade out across the lagoon and then skim out across the reef and paddle out the back. So, we call that prisons or the prison point or prison point to Maldivian language. They often put an U on the end of a word if they don't have it in their language.
I got you. Okay.
Biscuit's a Western word. Yep. Maldivians got it and called it biscuitu. but anyway, Honkies, Sultans, that was sort of in reference to the history of the Maldives, in that it used to be a group of sultanates in that country going back. Their history goes back a couple of thousand years. That's pretty interesting. Thor Heyerdahl did a lot of exploration and writing about the early Maldives or what he perceived was the early Maldives. But when it came to doing a commercial approach to having a surf tour, well, then, yeah, you kind of needed to be able to list formal names. So when people said to you, rang you up and said, oh, what are the surf breaks? You go, well, we've got Honkies as a left, Sultans as a right, and prisons or jails as a right. And we thought, well, we better decide if we're going to publicise it, what we're going to call it. So Tony and I were cruising up North Mali Atoll and it was this 89 or 90, working out how we're going to do this. And, well, what's this break? He said, oh, I call it Past a Point. Said, oh, why is that? He said, well, because the kid, back then the island was Tari Village, which was a very small 20-room Italian-run place on the verge of being quite run down. I said, why Past a Point? He said, well, the kitchen hands come out to the end of the island with the leftover spaghetti and hurl it out onto the rocks. the rocks has got the pasta there, so I call it Pasta Point. No, okay, Pasta Point sounds good. then we went up a bit further and passed another break and said, oh, well, what's this one? He said, oh, well, no, it's the island of Tulis do. Oh, got a name for it? And he said, oh, call it Colas. Well, why is that? He said, oh, well, because the Coca-Cola factory's on that island. Okay, fine. So I called that one Colas, which later morphed into Cokes. So sometimes some people call it Colas, some call it Cokes. And then there's the chickens. And we got there and stopped and had a surf. I said, well, what do you call this? He said, oh, I don't really call it anything. Well, what do you think? I said, what's on this island? He said, well, there's actually a chicken battery there. They do eggs, grow chooks and get eggs. All right, chickens it is. So they were all pretty, off-the-cuff type ones. Jails, I said, well, what are we going to call it, prison point or jails? Or I said, what about Jailbreak? Thinking of, I think I might have had the AC/DC song rattling around in my head at the time. He said, oh, what about Jailbreak? It doesn't sound right for the authorities. I said, oh, I don't think the authorities are going to take much notice of it, but it sounds good to me. Okay, we'll call it Jailbreak then. And there's no jail there now, of course, but there was a time in the early days after there'd been a coup attempt and we couldn't surf it for a number of years. That got changed. So, and then down in the south, through the central and outer atolls that Tony had travelled around a few times over the years, several times over the years, he'd found breaks there that he just, beacons, is called beacons because there's a beacon on the point. called Love Charms, because apparently Thor Heyerdahl found something, some sort of relics there. Antiques was called Antiques because Thor Heyerdahl found some antique pottery or something there. Tiger Stripes got Tiger Stripes because a certain light, the waves get stripes up them from the crevices in the reef. and the waves look like they've got stripes, so he called it Tiger Stripes.
See, I actually didn't know that he ventured all the way to the south as well and actually named the spots that are pretty famous today, right? Like when you talk about the southern atolls, you talk about Tiger Stripes, you talk about Love Chums. Like, I had no idea that he actually named these waves as well.
Yeah, all those main ones. There's been other waves throughout the middle atolls. I mean, he didn't discover every single break in the Maldives. There are odd breaks there that work on peculiar swell directions and large swells that most of the time they're not a break, but occasionally they're quite, you know, functional, especially if there's a really big swell going and the regular breaks are too big for the tourist surfers.
Yeah.
But those main ones, you know, yin yangs down at in the central atolls.
Next to Six Senses, yeah.
Yeah, next to Six Senses, you know, he called it yin yang because when they flew over it, it looks like a yin yang symbol.
Okay.
So, yeah, he covered most of them. There's now some of them have been varied by different innovators, if you like.
Yep.
But, yeah, he travelled all the way down through there in the 70s and 80s. And, I said, when I was staying in the, if you were asking about the maps, staying at his house in Himifushi, and the house in the early 80s was coral walls, tin roof, no electricity, sitting by a candle of the night time. That was fairly basic. But on the wall, we had a British Admiralty map of the whole of the Maldives.
Okay.
British Admiralty maps were very, very detailed. And he said, oh, you know, gone over that and looked at where the entrances to the atolls are and what their angle is. And I said, you don't sort of spend a lot of time going down, you know, surfing these breaks that you've found down there. He said, no, mate, really no point. Four of the best waves in the country are right here on my doorstep. Mm. Bastard Point, Sultans, Honkies and Jails. I'm within a few, couple of back then, I'm within a few hours sailing Doney of Marley, where his girlfriend or wife was by that stage. There's no public transport down through that area, so the only time we've been down there, if I, you know, unless I can afford to charter a boat or buy a boat, you've got to get lifts on fishing boats and supply boats, which is, you know, a lot of adventure and fun when you did it the few times you did it. But why would I go to all that effort when I've got the four best breaks in the country sitting right here?
Absolutely.
Quite so logical.
Yeah, absolutely. I have two questions. So the first one is about, you know, you mentioned it before, right? Like his first house, like no electricity, you know, candlelight, things like that. So, you know, I've been to the Maldives a couple of times now, and it always amazes me how you get out of the airport and literally you're surrounded by water. Everything is done by water. Like, you know, whether you need to go to places, you know, like taxis, connections, it's all on the water. So I wanted to ask you, who's been there very early on, like how it was back then. I mean, I can only imagine, like, there was nothing there.
Well, what you don't see now is a sail dome. Or it's very, very rarely would you see one, and it's probably for tourist purposes.
Mm-hmm.
In 84, probably 75-80% of Donies were still sail Donies, but that was the era where they were gradually, people were dropping the outboard the diesel engines into their Donies. And the Maldivians felt themselves been blessed again by Allah, but it just so happened that the shape of the typical shape of a Maldivian dhoni, which is based off an Arab dhow, doesn't matter how big the boat is, they've all basically got the same hull shape. And it's just perfect. You just lift up the decking, put in a bit of a boulder platform into the base, drop a diesel engine in, punch a hole through a drive shaft out the back, away you go. and you still keep your tiller the way it was always being steered by the skipper by his foot. So it was just a walk-up start for the Maldivians, whoever had a boat. As soon as you could afford to drop a diesel engine into your boat, whether it was a tiny little one or a great big one, you did it. But so the only getting around when I was there in 84 to get from Marley out to the island because I had to spend 5 days quarantine in Mali before I was allowed out to Iwo Jima.
Okay, well, why was that?
Oh, they said it was to do a bit with malaria and things like that. But apparently there was a – Tony once told me there was an underlying thing that it kind of slowed the hippie travellers from India coming over and going to the islands. Because back in the 70s there was a fair bit of that. And one of the reasons why they stopped village guest houses back in 84 was they were concerned at the influence of these Westerners that were coming and, you know, living on very traditional Islamic islands and carrying on like Western hippies.
Yeah.
And by having to spend 5 days in Mali, which cost you money, you know, even back then a room in a Mali hostel was, you know, probably 20 US a night or something like that, it just put a little bit of an obstacle for for the hippie crowd to get out there. But ostensibly it was about malaria, I think. Anyway, that was good. Mali was, you know, different. The highest building in Mali back then was the new mosque that was being built. And the only two-story places was, I think, the law courts down on Marine Parade down the front. But obviously it's now multi-stories all over the island. But so there was to get out to Himifushi, there was, I think it was like a once every 3 days, there was a supply boat that would go from Mali and take the people from the island that had been visiting Mali, take them back to Himifushi Island, and some supplies had come in. So whatever day it was, Tony said, right, well, you know, get down to the dock in Mali and by that time and get on this particular boat, it'll be called that, and pay the money and you'll get dropped off at Himifushi. I'll be there waiting for you. But other than that,
crazy
to get around. I mean, Tony, to go surfing, when I first went there, had a sail Tony. And this thing was, I don't know how long it was. You'd be lucky if it was 14 foot long. Traditional little sail Tony. And he amazed me there. I'd known him and spent good time with him in Sri Lanka. But, you know, righto, we're going for a surf. We're getting the boards. We go down, we grab the poles. You get on the little wooden Tony. You pole out across the lagoon. Pole out through the little gap in the reef, unless you wanted to go the long way through the harbour entrance, which was nowhere near the size it is now. Pole out to the outside of the reef, throw up the single sail, and to get to surf honkies from Himifushi, you'd sail right out to the back of Tumbaradoo Island and then tack right the way across and then tack all the way in. And judging from the current, the wind, the whole bit, judging this little single sail Dhoni, getting it right on the spot, basically doing a bit of a handbrake slide on the end of the reef. My job was to dive over with the anchor and wedge the anchor in. And then we'd spend pretty much the day over there just surfing at honkies. But watching him and how he'd learnt to sail, he was just like a native Maldivian when it came to sailing one of those little boats. He had it down completely. It's quite amazing. And then when I was there that time, he got his first motor. So he'd had a transom built on the back of the Dhoni and a Yamaha, like a Yamaha 75 horse or whatever, that he'd have him imported. And he was like a kid with his first bike at Christmas when he had that. And we didn't have to pole out. We just putted out and we didn't have to worry about the current. Motored out to the break, set the anchor, none of the tacking in and out, way out to sea to get the right angle to come in. So that was when he got his first mobility with his Dhoni.
I mean, these stories are, you know, I could listen to it, you know, for hours. I mean, it's crazy, especially for people who've been to the Maldives and they see the, you know, the transformation of the country. Like what you're telling us, it's unbelievable. And I want to dive into how atoll travel or adventures also was very involved in the community itself. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, in the first times, apart from, you know, the Westerners, to say it was wrong to say that it was the 10th surfer, the 10th foreigner, because he did get some of the young Maldivians to surf, got them into it. He said, well, wasn't worried about them keeping a secret. They weren't going anywhere to tell anyone. And it was great to have somebody to paddle around with rather than surf on your own. So that he kind of introduced modern surfing. I mean, Maldivian kids, like any kids anywhere in the world that's ever had whitewater following up, they've been using planks of wood and things to catch waves for forever. But for conventional surfing or contemporary surfing, the introduction was then. And Tony bought it. I've actually got the original board up behind me in my office here.
That's great.
The very first one that he got shipwrecked there with. So he encouraged a lot of them to surf. Early days of the tours, we used to run the first of the surf comps for the local guys at Pastor Point. Adult travel would get the trophies made up by a guy over here who used to make some pretty cool fiberglass wave trophies. I'd cart them over there. We'd run the surf comp for a couple of days at Pastor Point. And, that was the initial part of sort of mentoring a lot of the younger guys. And then, of course, it's the tours gradually picked up. Then Tony needed staff, so he always had Maldivian surfers, pretty much always with the exception of his mate Mark, who came out and helped out for a couple of years. But, he's had a whole range of Maldivian surfers, and even now, Tony's been dead 12 years, but coming up to 14 years, always encourage Maldivian surfers to do the job. And there's a heck of a lot of the Maldivian surfers in the surf guiding business got their start past the point without all the benches. Great long list of them. And that's been great. It's a job. It's a bit of a career path for them. I'd like to see it a bit more formalised over there, turned it into a really good career. There was a lot of give back there and to the local villages, because, I mean, the boat guys for Atoll Adventures, there's like a dozen of them now, they're all Inafushi locals. When there's things like the tsunami hit and those villages were so badly affected, we started a fundraiser through our client base, and I think we raised about $25,000 to $30,000 for the local village. There was a fair bit of put back there. I mean, Tony always felt, he used to say, "I thank Allah for the day that we got shipwrecked, because it gave his life his direction, and it gave it to him providing a heck of a lot of waves as well." But he got his dearly beloved Zilpha, he married, a couple of kids. It was the country had given a lot to him, so he was always very conscious about making sure that it was repaid in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I mean, you could also, this leads me to my next question or next kind of segment, and I want to talk about Pasta Point. Right. Like I had the pleasure to surf it. I visited you guys, I think 2 or 3 years ago now. And you could see for anyone who isn't familiar with this, Atoll Travel or Atoll Adventures, like your HQ in the Maldives is actually right at Pasta Point, right at Cinnamon Dome Valley. Right.
Yeah. Well, it was where the tours started. Tony picked that island for a pretty simple reason, apart from the fact that it had a little resort there that you could sleep people on. It was located, not within sight of Sultans and Honkies, and only less than 10 minutes in a putt-putt dhoni to get across to those breaks. Mm. So it was clearly the logical place. It's the best spot to do it. That's why he chose it. It remains, we believe, probably the best spot to do it. It was close to the Himafushi, which meant he could use his boats and use his village people that he'd used a lot, knew very well and trusted. So it sort of had ticked all the boxes, basically.
Yeah, I mean, when you actually are on the island, when you actually are at the resort, you see, there's a lot of memorabilias and I guess like memories that kind of like remember Tony. Like I remember there's boards, there's pictures, there is, you know, all sorts of stuff that people can kind of follow, you know, his story and what he's done for the Maldives. I want to dive in a little deeper into the whole setup, right? Like you already touched on it, why he chose the island, but how did it become a private wave? How did it become, you know, I mean, you don't have to be a core surfer to know that Pasta Point is one of the best waves, if not the best wave in the Maldives. Like it is a famous spot. So how did that happen that, you know, not only that the wave was privatized, but also, you know, the fame that kind of came with it?
It's not so much that it was privatized. Any island in the Maldives, a village island or an island leased for a resort, mm-hmm. has a certain jurisdiction of water around it, whether it's the area inside an outlying reef or whether it's from where the channel finishes, if there isn't an outlying reef. In the situation of resort leases, most of the resorts are granted X amount of meters to seaward outside their resort as part of their jurisdiction. It's just the way the industry works over there.
Okay.
And when we started at Pasta Point, there was a resort there. And the background to it actually came as probably we'd been a couple of years into it. And we had a group of guys there. And then all of a sudden this boat came down with a bunch of surfers. I won't say which nationality they were. But they just jumped out and raided the break. And it turned out that they'd booked a holiday to the Maldives, figuring that getting to the surf was really easy. And they booked a resort further to the north that didn't have a surf break. And then they found out it was an arm and a leg to hire a boat to go anywhere. So eventually they all said, we've got to get some surf. So they hired the boat, paid the arm and leg, came down and just took it out on the crew at Pasta Point. Because our guests came in and went to the manager and said, what's going on here? These guys are just coming, hassled us, dropped in on us, used us, stolen all the waves. And the manager of the island said, well, that doesn't seem right. So he contacted the boss of the company that had Pasta Point or Tari Village in those days, who then contacted the tourism ministry, et cetera, and was told by the ministry, well, that body of water is under your jurisdiction. It's up to you to keep it safe. So from then, it was like, well, we're not going to have our experiences like that happen again, where non-guests just come and, you know, ruin it for our guests who are paid to be at this resort and surf this way. So it's always been that way. It's been that way from the start. So there was nothing innovative about, anyone privatizing the break. Yep. It's the house reef, if you like, they call that. And the same, you can't go into any resort island and do what you want inside their territorial waters.
Absolutely. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
That's how it works. It's a sustainable thing. And we're running at 33 surfers now. It was 30 for many years. As it became more popular, as more companies started to get out there and more charter boats got into the game, the place got more and more crowded. We would have made a lot more money if we didn't bother about the winner. But it was always Tony's thing. He said, I don't want to be here and run this in a supermarket style. He said, we want to keep it this way. And we stopped doing inner atoll, that's like North Mali, South Mali atoll. We stopped doing any boat charters there about, I don't know, 15 years ago, just because, well, what do you need to do a boat charter here for? Stay on the island. The other resorts that had surfer catering for the surfing market. So we only ever then did boat charters in the southern or central atolls. But one by one, whether that was naive, I don't know, but one by one, a lot of the other companies, you know, they had their websites with 10, 15 boats being advertised, and every Maldivian that had a charter boat was into surfing tours. And it got a little bit out of hand there for a while. I think it's eased off now, purely because, as you understand, surfing's one of those activities And again, with the numbers, as we've had different management and ownership companies at Tari Village / Cinnamon Don Valley / Past the Point, and the new management company going, wow, you're doing such a great job. It's great. You have 30 servers. Why don't we make it 60?
Yeah.
Tony and I, we have to get the magazine out and get the pencil out and draw a reef and explain that it's one person per wave and only so many waves come through in a day on a good day. And the simple analogy is, you know, if you've got a perfect, you know, head-high glassy day out past the point with five guys in the water, that is surfing heaven.
Yeah.
But exactly the same day with 50 guys in the water is surfing hell.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Once they understand that there's the sustainability aspect to it, then they're fully supportive of that because they want their people, they want the tour to run with. I mean, we work on about 70% repeat bookings every year. Now that COVID's over and the Australians and the Kiwis will be able to get back in, we'll probably be up over 80% repeat of bookings this year.
Mm-hmm.
Just because they keep coming back, some of them year after year after year, because they know that's the quality of surf experience they're going to get.
I mean, like I said before, right, like the setup is amazing. Like, the way it's managed, just the setup itself, the wave. So for anybody who hasn't checked it out, I mean, it's highly recommended. Like, you guys are top notch there for sure.
Well, thank you, Sonny. We like to think so.
No, absolutely.
And it's how well it's run. I mean, Tony set that all up, but then Dara, who's the operations manager for Adult Adventures, I mean, after Tony's died, his son came back out from Australia and he's kind of taken over management of the of the company. But Dara's the operations manager of the day-to-day business on the island. And he's been doing it for 26 or 7 years. He's the nicest, politest, most diplomatic guy, but very well organized. It's not just the wave, it's not just the location, it's not just the consistency, but it's the team that he puts together and the staff that make it a great experience for people. They get to know the surf guides very well, and Dara has it really, really well coordinated. That's a part of it. You know, the boats are available all day. They're not set to a timetable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Maldives, that the winds can change, the current can change.
Absolutely.
And you need to have that flexibility. So the first boat's ready at 5:30 in the morning and the last boat's ready to go out at 4:30 in the afternoon for the evening session. They have to be available like that to take account of when the current's going to kick in, what that storm's going to do and when the wind's going to swing, whether the swell's on the up or the down. It needs that flexibility. And so all the boats are connected with walkie-talkie. And, you know, if we've got a boat sitting over at Jails and somebody's a bit interested, ring up the boat. How many's out in the water at Jails? Oh, heaps or not that many. Or the call might come in from one of the boat guys. Hey, the charter boats here have all gone for lunch. There's only five or six in the water. Send some guys over. That sort of ability to move your guests around the break at the optimum times, that makes a lot of difference.
I mean, like I said, you know, it's like, it's such a nostalgic place as well, because yes, you said it before, it's not just the consistency, it's also the operation, but also it's the whole backstory of it as well that kind of makes this place, the wave, you know, the setup very special. And yeah, I definitely felt it when I was there.
Well, it's been 30 years of my life, Sonny. Whenever I go over there, I mean, it's transformed from a rundown 24-room place. It's been taken over. It's had millions of dollars thrown at it. It's had reclamation. The shape of the island, it bears very little resemblance to the shape of the island in 1984 or 1992, when we first put the tours there. It's had a lot of development done to it over the time, but that's, again, typical of Maldives and their tourism industry, developing islands, even creating new ones to put a resort on. I kind of, each time I go over, the older I get, the more I go back and look at it and just sit there and sometimes pinch myself thinking, Well, that's been an interesting 30 years, hasn't it?
I mean, certainly has, you know, with all your stories and all your travels. I think, you know, this like last 50 minutes we've been talking, I mean, it's been, you know, you kind of took us back in time. Like it was awesome. It was great.
You're welcome.
And I'm out of questions. So if, I don't know, I don't have anything else to ask. I was just sitting here, you know, like mesmerized by the stories and, you know, things I've never heard before. And I've learned a lot during the last 50 minutes. So is there anything you want to add that we haven't touched on that, you know, the world needs to know about, you know, Atoll Travel, Atoll Adventures, about you, about Tony, you know, whatever it is?
No, not really. Tony died in 2008, and his wife had died a few months earlier than that. We've had some ups and downs. We've had some really tough times. We've had some great times, but that's the travel industry.
Absolutely.
You know, things. We used to do a bit of eco-cultural tourism in Sri Lanka, and it'd be going good for a couple of years, and then something would flare up and you couldn't do it for another year or two. What the Maldives have, you know, what did Tony get through? I mean, he was in his house with his wife in Male when the 1988 coup attempt was on. He was in Sri Lanka during the tsunami, lucky to have survived that. In Sri Lanka in the early 80s when the troubles blew up and the island was just going berserk. He having been shipwrecked there, he saw a bit more excitement after that. So there was all sorts of things that had happened, but even since then, COVID's been probably the worst of it. We were lucky, all of us, to deal with the Maldives, that they only really shut down for 4 or 5 months. And the Maldivian government did a very good job of managing COVID, I believe. But they had the geography to allow them to do it. You could fly people in. As long as you knew that they were negative, you put them on a sanitised speedboat and send them to a sanitised island, and they could at least have their holiday there. So they did. The Maldivian government, I think, did a good job with COVID and really saved their economy, because it's like 90% of their economy is based on tourism. So they couldn't afford to have been out of action, you know, not like Australia shutting your borders for 2 years.
Absolutely.
So they did a great job with that. But it's been a hard couple of years, the COVID. But for those that managed to get out there in the second half of 2020, they were getting surf around there. Lack of crowds hasn't been seen like that since the early to mid 90s.
Yeah, that's true. I was actually there in May last year, and it was crazy. There was no one there.
Yeah, well, good luck to you. I've just been to the Maldives, and this is my first trip back since it started. I hadn't been there for 2 years. It's the longest I haven't been to the Maldives in 35 years or something. That's just how it goes. The place develops. It would have been nice if it hadn't become quite so popular, but when you think of the Maldives geographically, it's good to travel to from Australia, from Europe. The waves there are super heavy, so a lot of the newer surfing nationalities, which are, you know, a lot of the Europeans that aren't traditional surfing countries. We get Russians, Germans, Croatians. There's all sorts of people out there surfing now, but as I've said for many years to people, when they ask about the surf, the waves are picture postcard perfect, but they don't have 4-foot clips.
Yeah.
And the older guys, and a lot of our clients past the point of, you know, in the 45 to 65 to 70 range, and, you know, they did all their adrenaline surfing back in the 70s and 80s in Indonesia, places like that. They surf for fun now. So fun and camaraderie of it. And the Maldives is a great place for that, because they're just so user-friendly. Most of the breaks, you know, there's a few breaks that are a bit heavier. There are some that have got some heavier sections. But they really are very user-friendly type surf. And so it's, it shouldn't be surprising that so many surfers of all standards like to go to the Maldives.
Absolutely.
Maybe a few too many at times.
Well, surfing is a popular sport, and you know, it's definitely increasing in popularity all over the world. So
yeah, well, we're going to build some more wave pools. Exactly. Get them all into wave pools.
Yeah, that should be. That's probably another topic for our podcast as well, talking about the rise of the wave pools.
Yeah, you don't get cut by coral, and there's no biteys and stingies out in a wave pool.
That's correct.
Leave the ocean to old people who don't mind getting bitten or stung.
That's correct. Anyway, Ian, thank you so much.
I now take my tongue firmly out of my cheek. No worries, Sonny.
Thank you so much. Chat again sometime. Absolutely.